Rima had known from the beginning that this was big trouble coming. She could hardly believe Patience had run off, and in fact, it seemed she had been abducted. That happens sometimes, girls stolen away, but usually no one would bother a ranger's household. And the man had said, loud enough to be heard, that he had business with Mitch. She hadn't wanted to tell Mitch until she knew for sure what had happened. Mitch was at a meeting, an important meeting. But his younger brother Jed had stopped by, as he often did, and when Tertia came in to report that Patience had still not come home, he took it upon himself to find Mitch. He'd like to give orders, Jed did, and Prima knew that his ambitions went beyond being a ranger's brother. He wanted that star for himself, and Mitch couldn't see any danger in it. And then Mitch had come home, in a rage with her for not supervising the girl better. It seemed the woman who'd been captured at the same time as Patience had disappeared from the Crockett Street nursery. He'd called the older boys, and they'd all gone out to search. And he'd sent for the parson to come and preach at her and the women all afternoon. It was more than a nuisance. It was baking day, and they had to leave the dough rising to sit in silent rows and listen to Parson Wells lecture them on their laziness and sinfulness. Prima kept her eyes down, respectfully, but she did think it was a shame and a nuisance to stop hard-working women in their work and make them listen to a scolding about their laziness. And he would go on and on about their sins tainting their children. Prima had trouble with that bit of doctrine. If, hard as she tried, her faults had made poor Sammy a cripple and simplicity stupid, then how could the Outland women, who had arrived after lives of sin and blasphemy, bear such beautiful, healthy children? Mitch had come home late that night, having found not hide nor hair of Patience, or presumably the other woman, the yellow-haired one. Prima wanted to ask about the yellow-hair's babies, but she knew better. He was in no mood to tolerate any forwardness, even from her. She set the house in order and waited by the women's door, but he never came to her. Early the next morning, she heard him leave the house. When she peeked, Jed was with him. She had hardly slept. She heard the roar of a departing shuttle from the spaceport, and sometime later, another, and another. A few hours later, a tumult from the boys' section drew her to its entrance.
Settle down! Be quiet!
Randy, Tertia's youngest boy, shot out the door.
Daddy's dead!
Prima caught him. He flailed at her.
Let me go! Let me go!
The tutor followed close behind.
Prima, put him down!
The tutor, though a man, was not Mitch, and she dared look at his face, pale as whey.
What is it?
That abomination. She stole the shuttle and tried to escape. Ranger Bowie and the others went after her. There's been a...
Light stabbed through the windows, a quick, shocking flash of blue-white. Prima whirled, suddenly aware of her heart knocking at her ribs. The tutor had opened the window and peered out and up. Prima followed him. Outside, cars had stopped cantways, and men were looking up. Prima dared a look into the sky and saw only patches of blue between white clouds. Ordinary, unthreatening.
I want to see the news vid.
And she walked into the boys' part of the house without waiting for his permission. Prima could hardly make sense of what the men on the news vid were saying. Escape, pursuit, invasion, mobilization.
Invasion? Well, who could be invading? And why? What's happening?
The older boys were already moving toward their gun boxes. Daniel, Secunda's third, looked over to her.
It's the heathen. Come to try to enforce their dirty ways on us.
Why?
Don't worry, we'll protect you. Now you get on back to the women's side and keep order.
Prima turned to go, still unsure what had happened and what it could mean. In the kitchen, Secunda and Tertia both turned to her for an answer as to what the light meant.
I don't know.
Prima gave a moment's thought to who could know. Temptation tickled her. No, she dared not risk her soul asking an outlander such questions, but she made up her mind and went out to the weaving shed.
Miriam!
The outlander woman turned from her loom. Her face was tight with tension. She must have seen the light, too.
Do you know what that light was?
Miriam nodded.
Was it from space? From ships?
Another nod. This time with a big grin, a triumphant grin. Miriam mimed a rocket taking off, shooting another rocket.
Who would do this? Why?
She jumped when Miriam touched her arm.
What?
Miriam mimed writing. Mitch, she recalled, had threatened to take Miriam's right hand if she didn't quit writing. She'd hoped it wouldn't be necessary because the woman was a gifted weaver. Now she led Miriam to the kitchen and gave her the pad of paper and pencil they used for keeping accounts. Light is weapon, Miriam wrote. Prima squinted, trying to read as fast as Miriam wrote. Weapon, that was clear. Ionizing atmospheric gases. That made no sense. She didn't know any of the words. Miriam, glancing up, seemed to guess that. Made air glow. But air couldn't glow. Air was just air, clear unless there was smoke in it.
Who? Who would attack us?
Guernsey Republic. Emerald Worlds. Baltic Confederation. Familius Regnant. Prima had no idea what those were besides godless outlanders. Battle in space, not attacking here. Someone you stole from. Prima narrowly stopped herself from slapping Miriam.
We don't steal, we are not thieves.
Stole me. Stole children, women. Killed men.
That's not true, you're lying. The children had no families, and you women were rescued from a life of degradation.
But Miriam had been here for more than 10 years. If she still believed she had been stolen, if she had not understood... I can prove it. Get to a transmitter. Call. Find out who that is and ask them.
I can't do that. You know it's forbidden. Women do not use men's technology.
But if she could find out, if it was possible... Miriam wrote, I know how. It's easy. Forbidden knowledge. Prima glanced around, realized that the others in the kitchen were staring, trying to understand this conversation.
I don't know where such machines are.
I know how to find them.
How?
Tall, thin things sticking out the top of buildings.
It's still forbidden.
Thinking of looking up at the tall, thin things made Prima dizzy in her mind. Thinking of touching men's machines was worse. We can look at the news feed. Miriam must mean the machine kept for the women to watch religious broadcasts.
How? I don't know how to set it up.
Miriam smiled. I do. She went to the closet where it was kept and pulled it out. More than a little afraid, Prima helped her pull it, on its cart, into the back kitchen, where there were extra electrical outlets. Miriam uncoiled the nest of wires that Mitch had left and plugged this one and that one into the back and sides of the machine. Prima had no idea which went where and kept expecting the machine to burst into flame. Instead, a picture appeared, the same background as the one she'd seen on the boy's side. This time, only one man looked back at her. Miriam kept tinkering with the machine, and suddenly it had a different picture, crisp and colorful. Men in strange uniforms, very odd-looking. Prima felt faint suddenly. Some of those odd-looking men in uniform were women. The view narrowed, concentrating on one of them, a woman with dark skin and eyes and silver hair. Miriam touched one of the machine's front controls.
These are our demands. Return of children captured with the piracy of the ship Elias Madero. Return of infant children born to Sarah Meager during captivity. Your ships are destroyed. Your orbital station is destroyed. To avoid more damage and loss of life, you are urged to cooperate with us. This message is being transmitted on loop until we receive a reply.
Ships destroyed? Mitch's ship? Is he dead?
Prima felt the weight of that loss. If Mitch was dead, someone else would be Ranger Bowie, and she and the rest of Mitch's wives and children, would belong to Mitch's brother Jed, if he lived. Jeffrey, if Jed had died.
Turn that off, Miriam, before we get in trouble. Put a tablecloth over it.
Prima knew she should put it away, but if Mitch was not dead, there might be more news of him, and she could not bring herself to lose that connection.
It's past lunchtime, and we haven't served. Feed the children. Now, come on now. Feed them. Put the babies down for naps. What would Ranger Bowie think if he saw us like this?
They were washing up when Jed arrived, white-faced.
Prima, it's terrible news. Mitch is dead or captive. All the Rangers are. Get me food, woman. Somebody has to take over.
Prima scurried out, driving the maids away. She would serve him herself, safer. When she had piled his plate with roast and potatoes and young beans, she summoned Miriam.
Turn it on, but keep it low. Be ready to hide it again.
The next time she came through the kitchen, all the grown women were clustered around it. The screen showed Mitch, sitting miserably at a table, not eating, with men she knew around him. Terry, John, and there was the captain, Ranger Travis.
Prima, get out here!
Prima scurried away, resenting once again that part of scripture which would give her to this man just because he was Mitch's brother. Mitch Pardue came to in the belly of the whale, a vast, shadowy, cold cavern, as it seemed. He blinked, and the threatening curves around him resolved into something he recognized instantly as part of a spaceship. Not the shuttle, though, and not the space station he'd been on. He looked around cautiously. There on the deck nearby were a score of his fellows, most still slackly unconscious, one or two staring at him with expressions of fright.
Where are we?
He pushed himself up, and only then gathered his wits sufficiently to realize that he was dressed in a skimpy ship suit with no boots, with plastic shackles on his ankles. He felt his heart pounding before he identified the fright that shook him. He cleared his throat and stiffened in outrage and terror.
No.
He tried again, forming a soft word with his mouth, and no sound emerged. He looked around frantically. On one side of him, the bodies of his own crew, men he knew well, now more of them awake and mouthing silent protests. On the other, another clump of men he knew. Pete Robertson's bunch, he was sure, beginning to stir, to attempt speech, to show in their faces the panic and rage he felt in his own. The troops that entered sometime later did not surprise him. He braced himself for torture or death. But after checking his shackles, they simply stood by the bulkhead, alert and dangerous, waiting for whatever would come. He should rally his men and jump them. He knew that, as he knew every word of scripture he'd been told to memorize. But lying there, mute and hobbled, he couldn't figure out how. He turned his head again and saw Terry watching him.
Get ready.
He tried to mouth it, but Terry just stared at him blankly. He nodded sharply. Terry shook his head. The women had been able to lip-speak to each other. Some of them had a hand language, too. Men should be able. He tried again, this time looking past Terry to Bob. Bob mouthed something he couldn't figure out in return and looked scared. Mitch was plumb disgusted. Giving up this way, what were they? He rolled over to attempt something with Pete, but one of the guards had moved and was making very clear gestures with his weapon. Mitch looked closer. Her weapon.
Stop it. No whispering, no mouthing.
The weapon in her hands was rock steady, and he didn't doubt the others would get him if he tried anything with her. Mitch looked up into dark eyes like chips of obsidian and didn't make a sound. Another of the soldiers walked up to the smoocher and deliberately kicked him in the balls. Another group of soldiers arrived. Mitch found himself suspended between two in space armor, propelled down a corridor to a large head.
Use it.
Mitch had urgent need, so did the others alongside him. From there, they were taken to a compartment with a long table set with meal packs. Mitch knew he shouldn't eat. He should starve himself rather than eat with these heathen. He tried to signal his team, figure out a way to stop them, but four of them were already tearing open the meal packs. He sat rigid, jaws clamped on his hunger, while the others ate. After a short time, two of them dragged him away to a small cubicle where he faced someone in a fancier uniform.
You won't eat?
Mitch shook his head.
Then we'll just have to feed you.
And in the humiliating struggle that followed, strong arms held him down while he was force-fed some thick liquid.
You do not have the option of suicide or resistance. You are going to cooperate with us. You have no choice.
After that, they took him back to a different compartment, a small, solitary cell. Mitch had, once or twice in his young days, traveled under a fake identity on Familius Registry ships. He had seen a few of the big commercial orbital stations. But nothing he had seen was like the interior of an elite warship. He wanted to despise it. He wanted to sneer at the exaggerated courtesy, the grave ritual, the polish and precision. But without a voice, he could do nothing but experience it. And in that experience, realize how foolishly he had misjudged his opponents. He had called down God's wrath on his people, and here was the instrument of that doom. Sleek, shining, perfectly disciplined, and utterly deadly. He wanted to defy them. He wanted to hate and defy and condemn and resist to his last breath. But he kept thinking of Prima and Secunda, his wives, his children, who would be someone else's, who might be forced out to work in someone's fields, who might be crying, unprotected, afraid because of him. He woke sweating, his own eyes burning. In the empty hours, staring at the blank walls, he saw deeper into himself than he ever had or wanted to. God was punishing him for his ambitions. That was only right, if he had done wrong.
But my family, why should they be punished?
His appetite disappeared, this time from no rebellion, but sadness. And his captors did not force him to eat this time.
We have only the smallest chance to get those children out alive. I know you want nothing to do with this Ranger Bowie, but unless he tells his wife to give them up, she won't. And he is the only one who can influence his brother, who has now inherited responsibility for his wives and children.
But it's ridiculous. Why can't we talk to her? I see no reason to negotiate with him. He's our prisoner. He's going to get a good, quick legal trial and the death sentence.
Do you want those children? Their families do. Their families will want to know why all these lives were expended for the Speaker's daughter and children of their own family left in slavery.
All right.
Mitch had not been to the bridge of a warship of this size. He was almost drawn out of his misery by the size, the complexity, the implications of power. His guards led him before a woman in night-dark uniform, with insignia that he recognized as an admiral's rank and bright-colored ribbons on her chest. And he stood before her, barefoot and voiceless, and wanted to see in her the very image of Satan, but could not.
You have a choice, Ranger Bowie. Your former prisoner, Hazel Takaris, insists that you truly love your wives and children.
Mitch nodded.
We are going to retrieve the other children you stole from the Elias Madero when you murdered their parents. However, the other men on the surface show no signs of cooperating with us. We are concerned that harm might come to your wives and children if they attempt to interfere with us, and we wish no harm to them. We want no child hurt, not so much as scratched. Do you understand?
He nodded again, though he wasn't sure he believed it.
But we will have those children returned to their families, whatever it takes. So, here is your choice. We can restore your voice for you to transmit a command to your family to release those children. Or, if you refuse, you can remain mute until your trial, however long that may be.
I might talk again. Have a man's voice again.
All around, he saw men and women listening as if they believed it.
Our landing craft are ready to launch. If they are fired on, they will return fire. If they are obstructed, they will fight through. And your people, sir, have nothing capable of resisting them. So it rests with you. Will you give these orders or not?
It was cooperating with the devil to take a woman's orders. A woman soldier, an abomination of abominations. For a moment, he thought of the weapons hidden in the city, the chance that the other men might be able to launch them. Yet, he could almost feel against his cheek the soft cheeks of his daughters, could almost hear his children's laughter.
Kill them? Put them at risk?
He nodded.
Good. Take him to sick bay and have the treatment reversed. Then bring him back to the bridge.
He was a traitor, a backslider. All the way to sickbay, he trembled with the conflict inside. His guards said nothing to him, guiding him along with impersonal efficiency. In sickbay, a medic eased Mitch onto a table.
We have to put you to sleep briefly, just long enough to relax the throat muscles.
He woke as from a moment of inattention and felt a lump in his throat.
I can talk.
Not to me, you can't. You can say what the Admiral says you can say. Now move.
Mitch sat where they told him to sit and faced the little blinking light that was a video pickup.
Jed, you listen to me. This is Mitch. And yes, I'm a prisoner, but that doesn't matter. I want you to let the people that are landing take those Outlander children with them. Prima knows which four, and send to Crockett Street Nursery for those twins. The yellow-haired woman's twins. I want all six of them released to the people that are coming for them, Prima. You get those children dressed now.
Signal coming up, Admiral.
Let's see it.
It was a vid from his home. Jed, looking angry, with Prima, well behind him, hands clasped respectfully in front of her. They were in the small living room, the one where he'd met the others so often, with the fireplace at one end and the conference table at the other.
Mitch, I don't believe it's you, or they've drugged you or something. It's some kind of trick. And I'm head of the family now, and I'm not about to let any children of this house into the hands of those godless scum.
Mitch felt the sweat spring out on his face, his hands.
Jed, you have to. They're coming anyway. If you cause them trouble, there'll be more people dead. Children dead, most likely.
Then they'll go to the Lord.
Behind Jed, Prima had moved. Without looking up to face the vid pickup, she had stretched out her hand and touched the fireplace poker in its stand.
I'm not gonna let the honor of our name be smirched because you got yourself caught like a yellow dog.
Prima held the poker. She held it easily, in a grip strengthened by kneading bread dough, wringing out wet wash, lifting babies. He knew the strength of those massive shoulders, those arms.
Jed, please. Don't risk the other children for those few. It's not worth it. Please, Jed, just let them go.
If they want to fight, they can have it. The preachers have already told us to gather and fight.
The preachers?
Mitch watched Prima walk softly, softly on her bare feet, coming up behind Jed, raising the poker.
You could stop them.
Jed had never understood anything he didn't want to. Mitch knew he should warn Jed. He should admonish Prima.
You could convince him if you'd try.
And on the screen, Prima looked up at last, straight into the vid pickup, and smiled.
Do it!
Mitch wasn't entirely sure who he was talking to. Blood spurted up, and Prima hit Jed again and again on the way down.
Prima!
She looked up at the vid again, her face settling into its usual calm from an emotion he had never seen before.
Don't let them hurt the children. Don't let them hurt.
I want to see what kind of people they are. You would trust with our children.
Be careful. Please.
Mitch knew it was wrong to be pleading with a woman, but his throat hurt and his heart, and he wanted no more pain for him or the children. The screen in front of him blanked. And then he curled around his misery like a child around a favorite toy.
I want to go. I should. The children know me. They won't be as scared. Brun would go if she could.
Brun was sedated, in regen after an attempt at the delicate surgery that might restore her voice. She wouldn't be out for another 3 days at the soonest.
Not a bad idea. And me, of course.
You? You're not only a civilian, but you have no role in this.
I'm the resident expert you brought along. I should get to see these Texas mythologists on their own turf. And I would recommend, Admiral Serrano, that you send a member of your family. Perhaps that grandson who keeps hovering around looking hopeful.
I hardly think Baron's an appropriate choice.
These people care about families. If you send a family member, you are showing that you will risk family to save family. It is also advantageous that he is male. That will be more acceptable, considering that there are women along.
I see. And whom else would you recommend? Do you have the entire mission plan in mind?
Why, no, Admiral. That is your area of expertise. Mine is the study of antiquities.
A lovers held position above the streets, and a mobile squad kept pace with them, helmet shields down.
Looks kind of silly, with the streets empty.
The streets wouldn't be empty if they weren't there.
Baron's helmet informed him of the location of hotspots in the buildings. They were clustered behind every screened window niche. He hoped none of them had weapons that could penetrate their body armor. He hoped even more that Ranger Bowie's transmission had convinced them not to fight. Right now, the fleet forces were on Code Yellow 2, which meant that even if they were fired on, they were not to return fire without authorization. Hazel pointed out the main entrance to the house and the side street that led to the women's entrance.
I came through this door only once, when he brought me here. I used that other door to take out refuse or go to the market.
But do you think we should go in here?
It establishes authority.
Professor Meyerson had elected to wear a skirt, though she agreed to wear body armor under it, which made her look considerably bulkier. She led the way up to the door. It swung open just before she reached it. A stout woman wearing a blue dress with a wide, flounced skirt glared at them. She had a flowered kerchief tied tightly around her head.
That's Prima, the first wife.
Ma'am, we've come for the children.
Prima yanked the door wider.
Come in. Which one of you is the yellow hair?
She couldn't come. She's getting medical treatment for her voice.
She abandoned her babies. Abominations like her don't deserve children.
Are they here?
Yes, but I am not convinced they should go.
Hazel stepped forward.
Please, Prima, let the children come.
Prima had the taut look of someone willing to die for her convictions.
I'm not giving those sweet girls up to some disgusting heathen.
It's just me. You know me. You know I'll take care of them.
You traitor!
No, ma'am. But I had my family to think of.
We were your family. We treated you like family.
Yes, ma'am, you did. As well as you could. But back home...
Prima turned on Professor Meyerson.
And you, you're what? A woman soldier. Unnatural. Disgusting.
Actually, I'm a historian.
Prima looked blank.
I study Texas history.
You... what?
That's right. I came to learn about you. About what you know of Texas history.
Prima looked thoroughly confused, then focused on Baron.
And you? Who are you?
Admiral Serrano's grandson.
Prima seemed not to understand.
The woman you may have seen in transmission, dark like me with silver hair, she's commanding the task force.
A woman? Commanding men? Nonsense. No men would obey her.
I do, both as admiral and as my grandmother.
Grandmother? Still, do any of you have a belief in God?
I do. It is not the same as yours, but in my family we have always had believers.
Prima looked closely into his face.
I do not understand, yet I see truth in your face. You are not a liar. Tell me, are you married?
Not yet, ma'am, but I plan to be.
To another one of these women soldiers?
Yes,
if I survive this.
Do you swear to me, on the holy name of God, that you are taking them to their families?
Yes.
Prima deflated, her face creasing into tears. Baron moved nearer.
Let me tell you about their families, ma'am, so that you will understand. Brandy and Stassi, Prudence and Serenity, as you call them, have aunts and uncles. Their dead mother's sisters and brother, their father's sister. Paolo's grandfather and uncle, and Driss's aunt and uncle. We've brought recordings of them, asking for the safe return of these children.
Prima looked down and away. She had the look of someone who will argue to the end, but knows she cannot win.
They are happy here. It will hurt them to move them now.
They are happy now. They are small children. And I know Hazel told us that you have been kind to them. But they will grow older, and you are not and cannot be the same as their own family. They need to know their own flesh and blood.
They will cry.
They may. They have had a difficult few years, losing their parents and then coming to such a different place and leaving it again. They cried when they came here, didn't they? But in the end, all children cry over something, and that is not reason enough to leave wrong as it is and good undone.
Prima folded her apron.
I am undone, but I had to try.
You are a loving mother.
Baron was surprised at this. He had not thought of Meyerson as caring about families. Yet her tone seemed to settle Prima.
I want you to see recordings of the children's families.
I don't have to. I believe you.
No, but it may help you understand.
Meyerson nodded to Baron, who set up the cube reader and display screen.
This is a recording of Brandy and Stassi's parents before they were killed.
On the screen, a woman with a long dark braid over her shoulder cradled a baby in her arms.
That's when Stassi was born. Their mother's name was Girion. Her parents were from Gilmore Colony. Brandy was a year old then.
A man appeared, holding an older infant in his arms.
That's their father, Vorda. He and Girion had been married 8 years. His family had been merchant spacers for generations.
The screen flickered, and now showed a slightly older Brandy, stacking blocks with an unsteady hand.
Boys' toys.
We value all the gifts God has given a child. If God did not mean her to build, why would he have given her the ability? They sent this recording to her grandparents. Her mother's father was a construction engineer in Gilmore. He was pleased that his granddaughter had inherited his gift.
The child pushed the blocks over, gave a dimpled grin into the camera, and stood up, dancing in a circle. Then her mother came into view, carrying Stassi, now a wiggly toddler herself. She reached out and caught Brandy to her, gave her a little hug. Professor Meyerson turned up the sound of the cube reader.
So, we've decided to take them with us. Captain Lund says that'll be fine. There are two children about the same age and a couple of older ones. The ship has a fully equipped nursery and playroom with all the educational materials you could hope to see, so don't worry about them falling behind. It's as safe as being on planet. Safer in some ways. No bugs. And no weather. I know, you like the changing seasons, but with these two, if it's not colds in the winter, it's allergies in the summer.
Professor Meyerson stopped the reader.
That was made just before they rejoined the Elias Madero, about a year before they died.
Was there sickness on the ship after all?
No.
Meyerson glanced at Hazel, who shook her head.
They were killed in the capture of the ship, ma'am.
No. It must have been an accident. Mitch would never kill women. You believe our men killed the parents? Orphaned those children on purpose? Killed mothers? That's why you attacked us?
They considered them perverts. That's what was on the recordings.
I don't believe it. You're lying. You have no proof.
Prima grabbed Meyerson's arm.
Do you? Does your device show anything like that?
Heads up. Maybe trouble on the way. Some kind of gathering across town.
A tiny picture flashed on the corner of Baron's helmet display, drawing his attention away from Prima. Someone in a bright blue bathrobe or something similar, yelling at a bunch of men.
Excuse me, ma'am, do you know what this might be?
He transferred the image to the larger screen they'd been using for the cube reader. Prima turned to look.
It's Parson Wales.
Parson is a religious leader. Amazing! Look at that garment!
Professor, I don't think that's the most important thing.
Oh, yes, of course. Sorry. It's just seeing things I've only read about before. It's quite exciting. I wish I had more time.
Not this visit.
Baron turned to Prima.
Please, ma'am, the children?
Come with me, then.
She led them on to a room where two older women and a dozen young girls from Hazel's age down were sitting, heads bent, over their sewing. Only the women looked up. The younger one stood.
It's all right, Quarta. They do have families. Real families.
Now the children looked up, shyly, staring at the intruders. Baron smiled at them. He didn't want to be a frightening memory. Two of the children stared at Hazel a long moment.
Patience?
Yes, I'm back. Do you remember your Uncle Stepan?
The child nodded, her face solemn.
He wants to see you again, and so does your Aunt Jazz. We can go home now, Brandy.
The girl's face lit up, and she dropped her sewing. Then she looked cautiously at the older women.
You may go with Patience. Hazel. Now, Prudence.
The girl ran to Hazel and hugged her.
I didn't forget. I promise I didn't forget.
She leaned back, looking up at Hazel's face.
Home to the ship? Will Mama be there? Can I use the computer again? Can I have books?
The other child, younger and shyer, had to be led from her seat. But when she realized she was actually leaving, She clung to Brandy's hand and smiled. The other girls stared, faces solemn. Clearly, they had no idea what was happening. Baron glanced at Prima, hoping she would make the necessary explanation. The older woman grimaced.
Prudence and Serenity are going back to their own families. We wish them God's blessings in their new life.
We will protect them.
The boys were in the boys' wing. Prima dispatched one of the other women to fetch them, while she herself led them to the nursery to pick up Brun's twins. Hazel picked up one twin, and Prima carried the other. By the time they were back to the front hall, the boys were there, looking worried and uncertain.
You need to hear this, Ensign.
Automatically, Baron switched audio to the speakers of the cube reader. The man in the blue robe was in mid-sermon.
Fallen into Satan's snares! God's judgment is fallen on those rangers and on their families for their sins. Suffer not the wicked to prosper, nor the ungodly woman to speak.
Professor Meyerson turned to Prima.
He means you. You're in danger now.
We must retake the rangers' houses and cleanse them of the filth of contamination. Destroy the infidels with holy fire.
Not that there's anything really to worry about. All they've got is old-fashioned small arms and big knives. You'll be safe enough in the ground transport.
No! They have whatever was on the Elias Madero. They said so when they were talking after I was captured.
What was on Elias Madero? Ship weapons?
I don't know, but something bad. Something they'd stolen from Fleet.
A cold wave ran down Baron's spine. The Guernesi had talked about arms traffickers and stolen weapons, and Esme had mentioned that her captain was concerned about missing nuclear warheads.
Major, it could be a lot worse than that. These guys may have our missing nukes.
I knew we shouldn't have brought a Serrano along. Things always get interesting with a Serrano along. All right, Ensign. Suppose you tell the Admiral while I see what I can do to keep these guys from using whatever it is they've got.
Baron had just presence of mind to sever the connection to the cube reader's speakers, then switched channels to contact Navarino in orbit.
We're on it, monitoring all local transmissions, and we have scan working on locating any fissionables. Get those kids out of there now if you can.
I don't want to be another man's servant. I don't want my children brought up in another man's house.
Baron spared her a glance, but no more. Then Prima grabbed his arm.
You, your grandmother is really the commander? You are a man of her family, and you must give me your protection.
I'm trying.
I want to go. Me. All my children. Take me to my husband.
Baron stared at her, startled out of his immediate concern.
Take you... You mean to the ship?
Yes. That man...
Prima pointed at the now blank screen.
He will give me to someone else. He may tell them to mute me just because I have talked with you. And if he knew I had killed Jed last night, he would certainly do so.
Heavily, with no grace at all, she knelt in front of Baron.
I claim you as my protector, in place of my husband.
Baron glanced around. Professor Meyerson had her usual expression of alert interest, and the guards looked frankly amused.
Let me talk to my grandmother.
No, it is you I claim.
She means it, and she'll probably do something drastic if you don't agree.
Fine. You're under my protection. Get your household together.
I can't speak for the other wives.
Would he give them away? Mute them?
Yes.
Then you can darn well speak for them, and you have. Get them together. Don't bring anything but warm bodies. Major, we're going to be bringing out the whole household. I don't even know how many.
Baron looked at Hazel, who shook her head. Even she didn't know.
We're going to need more transports.
Baron tried to think if they'd have shuttle space. They'd be fine if they crammed in, if nobody blew the shuttles on the way up. People started crowding into the front hall. Women carrying babies, girls leading younger girls, boys pushing younger boys ahead of them, and one man, a narrow, angular fellow that Baron disliked on sight. They all stared at Baron and the guards, but there was less noise than he expected. The girls were all looking silently at the floor. The boys were all staring silently, with obvious awe and longing, at the soldiers' weapons. Prima made her way through the crowd and dipped her head to him, which made Baron acutely uncomfortable.
I have sent messengers to the other rangers' houses, by the women's doors, to their ladies.
What? No, I can't.
You said I could speak for the other wives. As you are my protector, so you are theirs, through me. It is your people who killed their husbands, after all.
Baron looked over the crowd that filled the hall from side to side and was packed into the rear passages. Somewhere between 50 and 100 people, he was sure, and made the easy calculation.
We need more shuttles.
And what of the male relatives of the other Rangers, who were surely in their houses as... what was his name? That fellow Ranger Bowie had been talking to? Had been here. Wouldn't they resist? He could not possibly get that many people out of a city in riot without casualties.
What's your situation, Ensign?
Baron gave his report as succinctly as possible into the void of the comm unit. There was a pause, long enough to make him worry.
Am I to understand that you have undertaken the evacuation to our ships of the entire civilian population of that city?
No, sir. Only about 500 of them. Rangers' households.
And upon whose authority?
It has become a matter of family honor, sir, and familius honor.
I see. In that case, I suppose we are bound to support your actions, if only to have you present and accounted for when the bill comes in.
Contact! We are being fired upon. Say again, we are receiving hostile fire.
Engagement code open green. Say again, engagement code is open green.
Open green. New objective, new rules of engagement. She had given it to him. Baron felt a simultaneous lift and sink of the heart, which almost made him sick. Then he steadied to it.
In support of Ensign Serrano and an unknown number of civilians in the hundreds who will be embarking for evacuation, open green.
Baron could hear the Major's silent thought. The ground support, more than adequate for a small party, was far from adequate to protect and escort hundreds.
Support on the way!
Baron turned to Prima, still waiting before him.
They will send more shuttles, but it will take time. We will keep you as safe as possible, but... if you know anything of Outland weapons, where they are hidden, it would help.
If the rioters knew where the nukes were, if they could trigger them, there was no safety. A boy waved his arm.
I know something.
What?
Daddy gave Uncle Jed his key and told him right before he left to go hunt down that runaway girlie.
Baron's stomach curled into a tight, bold knot.
Key? That would be an arming key. And where's your Uncle Jed, do you think?
Prima waved toward a door across the hall.
On the floor in there. I couldn't think what to do, so I left him.
Check it.
One of the guards went in, shutting the door behind him on the smell of death that had puffed out into the hall.
Looks like an arming key on a chain around his neck. In the pockets, another key, different. Looks like he has the primary for one system and the secondary for another.
We have two arming keys, Major, from Ranger Bowie's brother. I expect each ranger had one or more keys and left them with his successor.
How many troops do you have with you?
Only the four as escort.
Damn! We need to get those keys out of those houses. These guys are insane. You should see how they're acting out here.
Esme Suiza, back on the bridge of Shrike, where she belonged, discovered that everyone aboard, including Captain Solis, who had given up the last of his doubts about her intentions, was treating her with excessive care. All the special crew borrowed from Navarino had gone back to their ship. Mahari, she knew, would not have treated her as if she were delicate crystal just because she'd had a spell of hypoxia. She felt quite fit for regular duty, more than willing to go back to work rather than sit by Brun's side as she dozed in regen. If she could have been on Jurfalcon with Baron, that might have been different. But soon enough, they'd be back at some base where they could finish what they'd started. After the third offer of a chance to take a break, she'd had enough.
I'm fine. It's my watch.
She caught the edge of a significant glance from Solis to Chief Barlow on communications.
What? Am I making mistakes?
No, Lieutenant, you're doing fine. It's just that there have been... developments.
Something cold crawled through Esme's chest, down toward her toes.
Developments?
Yes. While you were off watch, the landing party went down to retrieve those children.
What's wrong?
There have been complications. And Admiral Serrano's grandson is down there.
Why? I mean, I didn't think an ensign would be chosen for such a team.
He wasn't, originally. But he's there now, and since you and he... well, so I understand...
Yes.
He's managed to get himself into a dicey situation. And we're supposed to help him out, but I do not think you should be on the team. You've already had your stint at suited combat.
I am fine. I am perfectly recovered, passed by medical, 110%.
It is, of course, the captain's choice.
Don't start that again. One time for each trick. Besides, he had to chew his nails over your exploits on the station. It's only fair for you to reciprocate.
War isn't about fair.
You're right there, Sweeza. And if I decide your talents are needed, be sure I'll send you. If you can assure me that being in love with the Admiral's grandson won't warp your judgment or affect your performance...
I'm not in love with the Admiral's grandson. I'm in love with Baron. Sir.
Wonderful.
Baron felt he should be doing something with his charges, but he couldn't figure out what. If he took them out in the street to head for the port, they could be shot. If he kept them here, they were sitting ducks.
Serrano, taxi's here. Room for 15.
That simplified things, slightly.
Hazel, Professor, take the Elias Madero children, the babies, and, let's see.
Room for 15 adults. Make that 2 adults, 4 small children, and surely he could cram in 10 babies. No, another adult and 10 babies.
Prima, bring 8 more babies if you have them, and a reliable woman to take care of them.
That turned out to be a gray-haired woman as wrinkled as dried fruit. In less than 3 minutes, he had 10 babies, the 4 little children, and the adults all out the door and into the first ground transport vehicle. Baron looked up the street, to the flower-decked park at the end of it. In the middle, a great stone star shape. The points of the star were blunted, he noted, and seemed to have bronze plaques set on them. Suddenly, as he watched, a door opened across the street, and a woman scampered toward him, eyes on the ground. When she neared him, she stopped short.
Come on!
The woman dashed on, brushed past him.
And Travis's little brother, he took in this key, and he put it into this thing, this box thing. And then Travis's prima, she whapped him with her skillet that she was a-carrying from the kitchen, all full of hot grease and fried chicken. And that box was a-bussin' and a-bussin'. And she said, come quick, tell you, because one of her outland mutes, she wrote, bad, bad, get help quick, in the grease.
It's a bomb. The key's turning on.
Like a light? A switch?
Yes. If they're the bombs taken from us, it takes at least 2 keys to arm them. So no one can do it by accident. The keys have to be used in the right order.
Prima turned to the woman.
Where are the keys?
I don't know, ma'am. She only told me to come tell you because you'd sent word we used to get out and Ranger Travis's brother. He said no, we was all horse of Satan and deserved to die anyway.
I'll send...
Prima held up her hand.
They won't trust you. They might trust my women. You want to be sure no one uses both keys?
Any keys, if we're not too late.
Prima dispatched another cluster of women, who followed the first back across the street. The next armored transport arrived. 1 baby left, then 6 toddlers, and women to care for them, crammed into that one. Baron noticed that Prima had no hesitation about which to choose, and those waiting their turn made no attempt to crowd or protest. 1 more would make a shuttle load, the shuttle they'd come in on. 2 sets of keys, he was sure, almost sure, hadn't been used. At least 3 more, and he would be lucky if that was all. A gust of acrid smoke blew past.
Something just blew in that pretty little park up the block from you, Ensign. Looks like it took the top off that decorative star.
Baron looked out to see, through the cloud of dust and smoke, an ominous shape rising slowly from the bright red and yellow flower beds.
I think we found the nukes.
The even tone of his voice surprised him.
They had a silo under that thing, and somebody used both keys.
For all the good it would do, he gestured to Prima to have everyone get down on the floor, and then replaced and locked his own helmet.
Would have been nice to have said goodbye to Esme, but...
It's not moving anymore. What's your visual on it, Serrano?
Baron peered cautiously around the doorframe, wondering only then why he'd left the door open.
It's about 30 feet above ground and not moving.
Our birds would be out and flying by now. Is this just a way to blow up the city?
Pleasant thought.
He had not thought of that, and hoped very much that hypothesis was wrong.
Shuttles incoming.
The ground shook as the incoming shuttles dropped V upon entering the atmosphere. The first armored transport, back for another load, ground its way around the corner as if nothing else mattered and paused by the door. Baron shrugged. If that thing blew where it was, it wouldn't matter whether people were in the house or the transport. They'd be safely dead. He nodded at Prima, who pointed at heads until the transport driver insisted not one more would fit in. Of course, if it blew as the shuttles were landing, all those would die too. His decision to save more lives just might be the cause of losing more lives.
Oh well, I asked for command track.
Troop drop!
Baron peeked out again to see the first shuttle doing a low flyby, its drop bay open and Marines falling, then steadying on their grav pads to form up with the others. A blinding bright bar of blue light stabbed across toward the north. A second shuttle, this one fatter and even slower, crawled past with its cargo bay open and disgorging dark blots he hoped were more weapons and some faster transport.
Equipment!
On grav sleds, big enough to hold 20 armored troops, steering carefully down to the wide streets around the central plaza. Once they'd gone to open green rules, attempts to match technology to that of the planet had gone by the boards. A column of black smoke. Baron could almost feel sympathy for the men with their rifles and their long knives. A grav sled settled outside the door, and its six occupants rolled off, leaving room for the women and children. Prima had them ready and sent them out the door without a word.
First shuttle's off.
So the original mission was accomplished, if they got those safely to a ship. The grav sled took off with a whirl of dust. The next settled in its place, and Prima directed a file out to it.
We're loading in all the streets.
Baron could see from the door the sleds landing and taking off in three of the streets around the plaza. He glanced around and saw that one more sled load would do it for this house.
It's your turn, Prima.
She's not going. She deserves to die, the murdering whore.
The scrawny man, the one he had not liked but had ignored after the first glance, had his long knife out and held to Prima's neck. Her eyes looked at him, a look that might have been warning, but was not fear. Then the neuro-enhanced female Marine who'd been checking the back rooms broke his arm like a soda straw, smashed him into the wall, and caught Prima before she fell. Her neck bled, but not the lethal spurt of a severed artery. The Marine slapped a field dressing on it. Prima looked at Baron, then quickly lowered her eyes.
You're a good protector.
No, she is.
Baron nodded to the Marine, who pushed up her faceplate so that Prima could see. Prima stared.
You're... a woman?
Yep, and a mother, too. Hang in there, lady. You're gonna be fine.
The last load went quickly. Baron swung aboard the grav sled and watched others loading and taking off as they swung above the city and headed for the spaceport. There he found, instead of the chaos he expected, a perfectly ordinary landing force traffic control section.
Ah, Ensign Serrano's last load. Fine. Bay 23, that'll finish the shuttle load.
Bay 23 had a shuttle labeled RSS Shrike. Baron helped his passengers from the grav sled to the interior with its narrow benches designed for troops in armor, not civilians in dresses. He started helping them strap in, ignoring the pounding of his heart, which had speeded up at the thought of seeing Esme again.
Baron!
His heart stopped completely, then raced on again. She was there, alive and well, waving from the front. He nodded, grinning but speechless with feeling, and went on with his work. Prima placed a hand on his wrist.
You know her?
Yes, she's...
He didn't even know what words would make it clear to her what his culture meant by engagement. Prima's eyes flicked to his face, then back down.
I will be an obedient second wife after you execute my husband Mitchell.
Baron could think of nothing whatever to say to that. Far below, as the last shuttles rose into the sky, the men at last made it to the Rangers' houses, the armory, the meeting hall. The houses were empty, but for a dead man or two in each, and the keys they needed so badly, were missing. Mitchell Pardue had been told that his wives and children were safe, but he hadn't believed it. Not until Prima stood before him, properly barefoot but quite improperly dressed in a bright orange ship suit with a sheet tied around it for a skirt. She glanced at his face, then down respectfully.
We have a new protector of the Serrano family.
Prima, you can't just...
Prima looked at him again, this time steadily.
I reckon you lied to me, husband. You said they was all orphans. You said those Outlander women was all you ever found. You never told me you killed parents in front of their children. that you killed women, even mothers. As far as I'm concerned, they might as well mute you, Mitchell Pardue, because if your tongue cannot speak the truth, why speak at all?
And after that, he found he had little need to speak and no one to speak to. In a last act of kindness that tore his heart, his captor showed him video of his children playing in the ship's gymnasium. They were almost to the security station at the fleet entrance to Rockhouse Major when they spotted the crowds on the other side of the barrier. The security detail moved on ahead to take up their positions.
Oh, Lord, the media.
You knew it would be here.
I suppose so, but I could hope. And you know I used to love being the top newsflash attraction.
Well, Baron could almost top you this time.
I do not really have 19 wives.
No. But do you think the media cares? It's a great story.
As may.
I wouldn't tease him. After all, you could be a sensation yourself.
Not me. I'm the plain one.
Oh, I don't think so. Land bride Sweezer, in love with a man encumbered by 19 fanatic cultists, and having gone from villainess of my abduction to hero of the rescue force? We might as well face it. We're all condemned to a spot on the evening news.
So, what's your advice, oh experienced target of the press?
Relax and enjoy it. In fact, let's give them a real show. After all, it's ours. We're the heroes of the hour. Let's do it right.
I hesitate to ask, Esme, do you know what she means?
No, I don't, but I think we're about to find out.
Link arms with me, you two.
We can't do that. We're sober, serious professionals. Fleet officers.
But Brun had already grabbed her arm, and they came out of the gate like a trio of chorus dancers into the lights and hubbub.
All we have to worry about is pirates, thieves, traitors, smugglers, assassins, and the occasional nutcase.
Esme looked past Brun to Baron.
Do you want to duck her in the fountain, or shall I?
Let's do it together.
Always.
The Serrano Legacy, Rules of Engagement, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 1998, Elizabeth Moon. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Nanette Savard, Elizabeth Demery, M.B. Van Dorn, Corey James, Peter Stray, Sonny Lasky, Sherry Simpson, Lily Beacon, Stephen Carpenter, Michael John Casey, Elizabeth Jernigan, Michael Glenn, Thomas Penny, Jeff Baker, Karen Carbone, Colleen Delaney, Tim Getman, James Lewis, David Coyne, James Konacek, Tom Simpson, Mort Shelby, Richard Rowan, Terrence Aselford, Ken Jackson, Kate Foster, and Chris Rowan. Directed by Nanette Savard. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry. Book adapted for graphic audio by Wilson T. Ferrier. If you enjoyed The Serrano Legacy, be sure to look for Rogue Angel, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
I'm Kyle Rayner, commonly known as Green Lantern. And there's a story that goes with that. What am I supposed to do?
Wear the ring.
For how long?
Until you die, or something worse happens to you.
Flip, flip, flip! Hey, that kid is shooting at me!
I'm here as a representative of the Justice League.
You've got, like, a club.
Something like that.
You screwed up badly tonight.
You remember the signaling device we gave you?
Where'd you find it?
On the floor.
I intend to know if you're responsible for the disappearance of the satellite.
Why do you think I might be?
You could be smarter than you seem.
Well, I'm not.
I was called Ganthet.
You're a half a million years old?
If my brothers succeed, there will never have been life on Earth.
It's up to us to prevent the end of the universe?
Graphic Audio presents DC Comics Justice League of America. Green Lantern. Heroes Quest.
If we do not do it, it will not be done.
Copyright 2009, DC Comics, all rights reserved. Justice League of America, Green Lantern, and all related characters and elements are trademarks of DC Comics.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.